Welcome to the We Hack Purple podcast, where each week we meet a new and interesting member of the information security industry because we want to learn what it's like to do all the different types of jobs. We have a very special guest on today. So he was on my book stream a few weeks ago. He's a fellow Canadian, which is awesome, but he works in a very interesting area of IT security where he is in the ICS community. So, you know, like nuclear power plants and stuff, that is Ron's jam. And we are sponsored this week by 10 Security, those nice folks that make Defect Dojo and help people by consulting and just like setting things up and fixing them and automating them. So let's meet Ron Brash and let's talk about securing big, serious things.
Well, thank you. Ron. Thank you for that lovely introduction as a fellow Canadian, eh?
Thank you for coming on the show. We're pretty excited to have you. We had so much fun with you when you were on the book stream.
Immediately, well, thank you. It was always a blast. Always.
Like as soon as we got off, my sound person was like, we have to have him on again. I'm like, I know. When's the best time? Let's figure it out. Let's just plug Ron into every space. So thanks for accepting our invitation.
No problem. This is a wee break before the rest of my workday continues. And I'm also 3 hours in the future, so it will continue.
Yes. Before we went live, Ron was explaining that his evening is far from over. It's just beginning. This is because industrial control systems are all over the planet and they are not necessarily in your time zone.
That's absolutely correct. And in the current world and the way that we do business for everything, a lot of people don't understand that there's externalities to everything. So if, for example, because some of you might be from BC, you're very probably familiar with Catalyst pulp and paper. Well, pulp and paper often winds up in products that, guess what, wind up as the packaging for your vaccines. And without the packaging, you don't get your vaccines. So everything goes left, right, and center. Way farther than you think, even beyond your organization. And that's what makes my interesting life very interesting, but it also makes it very problematic because you don't shut down a system when you do Windows patches on Tuesday.
On Tuesday, Friday. Okay, so I just realized I didn't tell everyone this is Ron Brash and I'm Tanya Janka because I'm bad at doing intros and I was just excited to have Ron on. Can you tell us what your job title is and kind of tell us roughly what you do besides saving the world every day?
Well, saving the world is an understatement. It's a thankless job for an industry that probably has very little expenditures for actual data security. So hi, I'm Ron Brash, as Tanya introduced me as. I'm a director of cybersecurity insights at Verb Industrial Protection. And so we focus on industrial cybersecurity for industrial control system environments, operational technology, and then the systems that often run on IT commodity infrastructure that support those industries. But besides my title being a humongous mouthful, what it actually means is I'm a super geek. So I get to present things in front of executive boards, absolutely. But then I'm also well known for reverse engineering embedded hardware and even bringing several products to market. So I get to do it all. There's less glamorous parts like running interviews and working with sites. It's not very sexy. But probably 50, 60% of the job is actually relationship management and helping teams feel less abandoned because they were the site, but then corporates in that nice ivory tower and mending the fences. There's a lot of that going on and trying to make sure people don't lose their jobs, as well as making sure you and I get all the products that we want. So it's a really complex thing, and also including the technical part, because you can't have the relationships without passing the technical sniff test. So it's everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to let someone touch your industrial control system, that's really serious. Can you explain what an industrial control system is for people who might not have heard of that?
Sure. So when you hear IoT, it's similar, but not at all the same thing. It's similar in the sense that it's often very small. It's doing something very close to something like a sensor or maybe even something cyber physical, right? It flips off an actuator, flips a relay, turns your light switch on and off. That's IoT. But when we get towards industrial control systems, they might share commonalities, but we're talking not about millisecond delays. We're talking about microsecond delays, even sub microseconds, as in like 400 microseconds. So very, very, very tiny, tiny stuff. The difference, though, is kind of in the way that these systems work. They don't get to be fleet repaired and thrown away every 3 years like your corporate laptop. We're talking about lifespans of 15, 20 years. These are the systems that I, instead of everyone dealing with the CIA triad, the confidentiality, integrity, and availability triad, we work in terms of SRP, safety, reliability, and productivity. So things that go boom, things that wind up with people losing their jobs, localized regions, not having an entire industry because that plant has ceased to production, especially in high volume, low margin markets like pulp and paper or even oil and gas in many regards. LNG is not profitable. So there's a lot of things that we do and we do, and it's fun. So embedded and control systems are the things that we take for granted, right? During throughout this pandemic, guess what? We had water, we had electricity, we had sewer, we had vaccines, funny enough. But as you start to see, certain things do and are will break down. And actually, after the pandemic, we are due for a lot of things not being available because the maintenance cycles and the prevention hasn't happened. And so, yeah, industrial control systems is a completely different world than just going to Best Buy and buying a new laptop.
Well, and like, I think that a lot of people have not realized how many things have been interrupted during the pandemic. Like for instance, you know, I wanted to buy some wood so I could build a greenhouse. It's tripled in price. That's wow. And so now there's going to be a housing shortage coming up because people are not like, it's going to cost more for all these different supplies. And I've noticed when I go, for instance, to the hardware store, that certain things that I know weren't actually affected, they're like, you know what? I'm going to bump it up 20% because I know I can, because all the other prices went up and people don't know. Yeah. And so like working in BC, we have the trees and we have the lumber, but apparently like a bunch of large American companies actually buy the lumber a year in advance. And so because they're struggling to keep up because of the pandemic, we're just not allowed our own wood, which sounds weird, but that is how it goes. So for instance, like you can buy wood at Home Depot in America, but then it's harder to get here at Home Depot because of the way supply goes. Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of interesting stuff after the pandemic kind of smooths out a bit.
Yeah, well, there's a few other areas that are similar to wood. So everyone says oil and gas, super evil, terrible for the environment. Well, if we had been very smart, asphalt is one of the most expensive things that you can make from oil and gas. And the tar sands do that. They actually make asphalt very, very well. It would have been a great time for us to pave all of our roads. But what people forgot was that because there was such a glut of fuel on the market, we're actually paying that at the pump now. Because the refineries cut production to raise the cost, and therefore we are accepting that because they run the gas stations. So Everyone is playing a game to a certain extent, but also because they need to cover their margins. If they weren't making profit, they need to reoccur it somewhere or regain it somewhere else. So there was a bunch of that happening. And if you work on the networking and hardware side of things, or if you work in the automotive, you'll find that, guess what? Your car lots have no cars on them right now. Well, because all of the commodity chips that are supposedly made in Taiwan are getting actually held up in China because of China First policy. So Cisco, a lot of Cisco equipment, I've been waiting on it since the spring, or my firm's been waiting on it in the spring for one of our customers, and it's not being made or it's not even coming in because Cisco can't guarantee the dates because of a China First policy. So there's a lot of stuff happening around the world that we don't see in the news, particularly in Canada or the United States. They've been too focused on things that are burning right now or vaccines and stuff like that before that. But there's other pieces that we've kind of taken for granted. And we're starting to see the repercussions of that after a year and a half, going on 2 years.
Honestly, Ron, when I look at the news and the fact that Twitter feels the need to share at least like almost every other day, masks are actually useful in the prevention of getting like the spread of the vaccine, and vaccines are safe. And they're the fact that they're trying to just deliver the basics because there's so many people in denial. How can they talk to us about more advanced things like those topics if they're just trying to deliver like general, I guess like they're trying to combat a lot of fake news, I guess is what it's called, or like rumor spreading or whatever, and doubt about scientific processes and such. And so like they're spending all this time doing that, and it's like we're missing the real news.
That's a great segue into cybersecurity basics.
Yes.
That's a great segue, because if we have to keep talking about them, and apparently AI and fancy things are going to solve all of our security woes, which they won't. Basics, people, basics.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Last week we had this woman on named Meryl Vernon, and she's a pen tester. And someone asked from the audience, they said, if we followed the CIS benchmarks and all the best practices, like turning on MFA, you know, using service accounts, all this stuff, like, would that stop you as a pen tester? She's like, oh, hell yeah. Mm-hmm. If everyone actually followed the advice and actually did the best practices, she's like, yeah, my job would be really hard. How do we get them to do the basics, Ron?
Well, we got to make them sexy. We got to make it, got to add glamour to it, glitter. I don't know what the right answer is. Maybe it's sequins, but that's what we got to do. And that's also true, not just for programmers, but even what we need as professionals. The world doesn't need a whole army of pen testers per se. The majority of cybersecurity is from a lack of maintenance and tidying up of user accounts and applying patch. Well, patching isn't necessarily the solution, especially in my industry. It's not because you have bigger fish to fry and you have to schedule everything. But when it comes to writing programs, things are very, very different in terms of the basics. And we need more doers. A lot of stuff can be done by just doing or planning ahead. In many regards, DevOps and lean stuff is actually kind of counterintuitive for security, because people cut corners going from sprint to sprint to sprint, and they paper mache upon paper mache without thinking through the concept. Is like, so, okay, I'm going to accept user input. So this sprint, we're making our interface. Where was the task item to sanitize the input? Oh, well, we'll do that in the next sprint. But that, guess what? There's another feature being paper mache'd on it. And that's the progression. Industrial is the exact same way. IoT is the same way. If I actually was a VC, I would recommend that no VC ever buy a startup that does IoT devices. Maybe buy it for the idea, but can all of the code, because it's entirely worth throwing out. So there's a huge thing for basics here, and we can go into many of those discussions. And I think that's, I guess, kind of how I also got into the industry, is by being pragmatic. So who knew basics are sexy and they get you a job?
No, they really do. I have a question. So there's some chat about actually about vaccines in the, but I'm not going to comment on it. But someone was saying, isn't part of DevOps security as you go? So in my opinion, security should start at the beginning and it should be a part of everything you do. And I have lots of thoughts on how to build it into DevOps, but is it de facto a part of DevOps? Well,
No, I thought lean agile programming practices would do more work with less people, so we can save money. That's what I've heard is from most organizations. So I kind of joke about that, but I'm saying that tongue in cheek. You would think security and engineering. Well, okay, let's look at it this way. The basics. If you look at the basic word security, security implies stability and the overall integrity of something, especially if you go after the finances sort of sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And 80-90% of the vulnerabilities in devices is related to poor engineering and poor coding. So for some reason, development and well-designed things are not integral, they're not intrinsic. And for some reason, maybe it's an ownership problem as well. Persons don't think security is their job. That's the cybersecurity professionals, or it's their tools job. I don't know what the excuse is, but that's one piece. And then if you're a DevOps person, you might be integrating other people's code and thereby infecting yourself. So who's responsible for that as well? So there's so much on all of those things that it all stems around not cutting corners and being a pragmatic. Maybe not super pragmatic, like in the sense of being dogmatic, but going back to the real sense of engineering and security and writing your code as such. Plan for the worst day and you can't be surprised. And you can do so without affecting your schedule too much.
Yeah, especially if you plan it out in advance. And especially if you template things, if that makes sense. So, you know, we're going to build an IoT device. And so last time when we built one, what were the security issues we came up with? What were things that were requirements that we need in every app? Like, let's build that in from the very beginning, make it part of our original plan. But yeah.
I'll give you an interesting example. So there was this concept of writing code based on parameters. So it was called dynamic programming circa 1980s. And it was built on the whole concept of using models to write your code. And so if you remember the earlier days of Unix and Linux and even Windows, your configuration files were super unstructured. You could do whatever you wanted to the drivers because nobody did any sanitization onwards you would go. And then along came XML with XSDs. And everyone's like, well, yes, it's super expensive performance-wise, da-da-da-da, off you went. But now I'm seeing the complete opposite where everyone's throwing everything into a binary JSON stream and there's no model to even properly parse out the results to know what your worst case is and what your allowed inputs are. So we've actually regressed again already within a short span of like 5 years. So there's all sorts of interesting things. Oh yeah, that's a good one, Kellen. Yeah, absolutely.
We should say it out loud for people listening.
For sure. Okay, so Kellen has a great point here, just to kind of go down a sidetrack. I know from an industrial standpoint, and he came from oil and gas, there's always a problem of cutting labor providers while increasing responsibilities. Absolutely, it's true in corporations. It's true everywhere, especially where if you're in an industry that has become globalized in general, where you need to be very, very effective and cost efficient.
Yeah. Okay, so Ron, what is a day like in the life of doing like securing industrial control systems? Or what is a day like in the life of like your job as a consultant trying to essentially accomplish that?
Ooh, there's so many things. And then we could even go back to when I was more of a developer as well. So being a consultant, everyone thinks it's very glamorous. It's like being an entrepreneur. And it's for some people, it's great. And being a consultant is also great. But also it's like having a family. If you're not just the only employee in your organization, it's like feeding a family. If you have employees, they're wasting your money if they're not making work that makes money. They're kind of like kids. But you got to feed them. And that's the piece here. But also you forget that there's a huge mental cost to it. And so if you're going to have a high stress life, potentially like myself, I'm not necessarily soapboxing that that's what someone should do. And I've paid some mental dues for that. But my day of my life is get up early and look at probably 3 or 4 pages of notifications. It'll calm down. Then the meetings start. And then you'll calm through and everything always comes in waves where another big incident comes out and you're getting calls about that particular thing or that vulnerability because the customer's like, I have no idea if this applies to me. I don't even know how to read an advisory. So there's those pieces. A lot of it's firefighting. A lot of it is doing assessments. A lot of it is teaching. And I try to do so without being very, as a vendor shill, I try to be more fussed about how I write or how I speak. Okay. And then on the other side of it, eating my family. I don't know what country you're in, but all right. There's that side. And then the other piece that you need to consider is that consulting is not a glorious job. For the most part, unless you take on very technical, well-defined scope problems. Consulting means you get brought in for one of two things. They need a scapegoat and you're going to get put under the bus. Or two, you're getting put in as a consultant to solve a problem because that business is unable to do so of their own because of toxic culture, has no money, whatever. And you're probably still going to get thrown under the bus at some point during that whole adventure. Very rarely do you get the third category, which is this is actually going to go somewhere correct. Maybe in very, like I said, very specific technical problems where it's well-defined what, you know, I'm going to make a device from start to finish. It's going to do A, B, and C. You can do that. That'll work out well if you're very good at it. But when you're going there to deal with human problems, build roadmaps, do technical assessments, it never goes well. People are unavailable. Schedules mix match. People are afraid to tell you the right answers. You have to go find them or surmise. You have to, I don't like the word manipulate, but that's the truth. You actually have to massage them into giving you basically the answer that you suspected was the real answer. You kind of just reposition them. You offer help at the same time under the guise that you're actually questioning them. There's a whole art to it. And I don't like that aspect of the job, but it is very important in order to get to the base of the problem. And I guess we could apply the same for coding if you're a lead. How do you make your developers get to the same point that you want to get them. And that does require leadership slash softer version of just persuade or lead by example, but it still is a form of psychological manipulation to some extent. And that's
also bribery. Bribery.
Incentivization.
Yeah, I will make baked goods and bribe teams with them, like banana bread, chocolate chip cookies. Like, I'm not above that.
And then the other piece is, depending on who your customer is, sometimes they tell you to jump and you got to jump 3 feet or sometimes 10 feet yesterday. But then simultaneously, what I'm doing as part of in my job is I'm also reverse engineering other devices to figure out how they work. So what, you know, it's undocumented, it's highly proprietary. Probably Bob or Jane has since retired or passed away, potentially moved out of the country, God forbid, or it was outsourced as well. So nobody knows anything about anything. Companies have been acquired, divested. So there's all sorts of, I never asked to become a historian, but I kind of have in many cases. So there's a whole aspect of there. And like, I want to go find an answer on Google. It doesn't exist. You want to call up a maintainer? Not possible. This is a whole other world. And then there's the whole politics about vulnerability disclosures, which we could talk about as well. That's another world where you need to be watching your back from the corporate lawyers. We thought we got past it, but we haven't. So that's my whole life is all of consulting, projects solving, vendors, teaching, speaking, you name it. And also raising a puppy named E.T., the Canadian APT.
Oh my gosh, he's so cute. He's so cute.
2.5 pounds.
So what type of puppy is he again? So he's a Chihuahua, but he's a certain kind of Chihuahua.
Correct. He's a deer-headed Chihuahua.
What a cutie pie. And not barky.
Does not bark.
Not yippy. Okay. Yeah. Sign me up.
But
a little
they're
dog.
Not recommend, they're not recommended as your first time dog.
Oh, really? Are they high maintenance?
They're not high maintenance, but you have to teach them and treat them in a certain way. We're still struggling with a couple basics like the pee pad, but everything else he's doing fantastic.
Okay. Yeah, I've never had a dog before. However, my bonus daughter, it sounds nicer than step, really wants a puppy. And I'm like, can it be as small as possible? And that dog is so cute, Ron. What about a Chiweenie? Have you seen those? It's like a Chihuahua and a wiener dog put together. Those are really cute.
So I always try to keep what's meant to be kept as something. If you start breeding things that are like long, short, with multiple weaknesses, you're not going to wind up with something happy. So wiener dogs are notorious for having broken backs, hip issues, joints, not deer-headed chihuahuas, but apple-headed chihuahuas, all are also the same. So kind of, again, there's another lesson there. Don't turn a product into something it's not supposed to be, or a piece of software. So chihuahuas are similar to that. And I could find analogies all day long for my dog or to cars and how to make them better. But
I have to say that is a really cute dog. Yeah. Oh, so there's some, apparently not everyone wants to talk about your puppy. So comment from the chat, like good comment. Given the Kaspersky vulnerability was known for a year or more, seems pretty wild out there with disclosing vulnerabilities. What is it like disclosing vulnerabilities in ICS? Like, because it's totally different when it's a power plant, right?
So there's the point of disclosing it. There's the point of actually getting that to the customer's hands eventually. There's the problem with the CPEs never, ever possibly matching something or even being disclosed. So if right now you go on ICS Cert, I checked yesterday, and there's a device called an Entron TCP serial gateway, and you go to check the CVE entry in NVD, it's reserved, which means they've never published it. It's locked up, and it's stuck somewhere. And guess what? No vulnerability scanning solution will ever find it because the CPE is not there. Secondly, the CPU has no meaning to even possibly be matched, because if you have things like, let's take a Linux device, for example. I'll give you an example of an ABB relay. It runs Linux on part of the system, and it's got an issue with libssh. So ABB would produce a vulnerability report, maybe somebody would find it. Maybe they would even see the ICS advisory page, but your vulnerability management tool won't, because it's looking for an ABB product or it's looking for a libSSH. And so it doesn't, they don't match, because you don't know what's inside of it. So that's kind of leading you to another part of software bills and materials. But in the proprietary sense, this is a whole ball game. The other piece is, just because I report the vulnerability to CISA, Homeland Security, various product vendors, doesn't mean they have any obligation to produce an advisory or disclose the vulnerability. It's all honorary. The whole entire system is honorary. We expect it from Linux, the foundation. We expect it from the distros. We expect it from Microsoft to a certain extent, because they hide stuff sometimes in bug fixes. Same with all the vendors actually do this. They roll it all up. You got to be very careful in your readmes and your change notes.
Because you might get extra fixes that you didn't bargain for.
So if you take BusyBox in Linux, you'll find out that there's not many vulnerabilities for it. But if you looked at the pull requests and all of the fixes, you'd find out that a lot of things like buffer overflows have been fixed and no one's ever reported as a vulnerability. This is everywhere in open source, except for maybe like the things that are under the most scrutiny, although arguably OpenSSL is not that great. But there's a bunch of that, or even in the web community, they do this all the time. They silently fix stuff, probably because they weren't looking for security. Like, oh, that's just a bug, and it works now. And so it silently gets rolled up into a fix. So there's a whole thing there of like stuff being hidden. Stuff is hidden on top of hidden portals for certain governments or certain relationships with vendors, and those will never actually hit NVD or any of the vulnerabilities. Yeah, it's full of politics. And then there's also the vendor has a chance to arbitrate between the researcher, the government entity, and then myself, for example. So I would be like, here's 10 vulnerabilities. It's non-refutable. And they're like, we'll deal with 5, take it or leave it. And we want them not to be 10s. We want them to be 5. So they monkey around with the CVSS vectoring string to drop it down as far as possible. Or they say, it's not my problem because there's a compensating control. And you can play this game until the kingdom comes. And again, after they've been published, no one's responsible for updating them as well and making sure the data sources are in sync. This is true for everything. And that's not just industrial control systems. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Why is it more complex to report vulnerabilities and actually get them reported for real in ICS rather than in general software, like an operating system?
I think it's got something to do with the ubiquitous nature of mainline operating systems. When you have control of the hardware, well, arguably nowadays with some of the Microsoft stuff like Surface Pros, when you get control of hardware and you have a certain ease of how you can patch and nuke the operating system and apply whatever you wish, that changes a lot on how you reflect and report vulnerabilities. People expect it. But when it comes to even your home router, when was the last time you got an update for that? Once you kludge a bunch of things together, proprietary or open source together, and put that in a box, the concept of owning a product from cradle to grave becomes very, very difficult. And generally, by the time a product has ever hit the market, the whole team that built it has either been fired, let go, or they finished their contract, or they've been already shuffled onto the next product and off they go, and maintenance is never considered.
Yeah.
And when I say maintenance, that also includes updating your core operating system. By the way, those of you in containers, please update your core operating system and your dependencies inside it. Containers are not a way to sweep everything under the rug. I'm saying that again, and I know it's coming. But yeah, that all of that stuff that I'm describing makes it so, so tricky. And then Kellen again had another great question. So about how do you secure something that's so remote, not physically secure, guarded, or like a pump jack or pipeline controls? Depends on what you mean by security. So physical security is a bit tricky, right? Cameras, barbed wire, I don't know, army of small chihuahuas. Maybe that's how you deal with it. But when you're dealing with things I don't ever actually try to tell people, don't trust your windmill. Don't trust your pump jack. Because that actually could be an entryway into your organization, because there's nobody out in let's pick a random place that's got pump jacks. I'm not that familiar with some parts of oil sands, but if you chose, LeDuc, if let's say there was Pump Jackson LeDuc, there's not that many people in LeDuc anyways. Or if you took a wind farm, like one of the ones I was in not too long ago, in the Northwest United States, that one state has a population the size of Victoria. Well,
wow.
There's nobody around and you could probably watch your dog run for days. So you really need to consider your physical aspects, and you assume that that site could always be compromised locally by someone physically. And you can't trust what comes out of it. Now, you want to monitor it. You want to do all your basics, but then you rely on compensating controls. Then you have stuff like maybe potentially pipeline controls, and those generally, so people forget certain things about pipelines. Pipelines are a logistics company. They move product from point A to point B. Everything is like a freight train. It's back to back to back to back with scheduling. If you screw up the scheduling, I can't guarantee what's in the pipe. I can't say that someone received 10,000 gallons of X. All of that starts to change. And so you just stop the pipeline because you can't control the billing and metering.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple to deal with that. And there's so many manual places in there. But you try to stage a lot of it. So security becomes very tricky remotely as well. But then you need to also make sure that you can trust what you have. And that gets very tricky, especially in assets like a pump jack or a well, where security upgrades, even on hardware that's long end of life, are not possible because you'd rather abandon the well and throw a concrete plug into it and forget about it for the remainder of humanity than to put in new products. So it's really, really tricky. And you kind of, one of the reasons why they hide vulnerabilities is for that purpose. You don't want the bad guys to know. Now, there's camps about this. You can pick your religious side of the debate. Some types of vulnerabilities in certain things, I do agree, should not be public knowledge. Yeah. But they do have to show up on a register somewhere, because otherwise the asset owner would never know they exist.
Yeah, and how do you fix it if you don't know about it? It's hard.
Well, you can't fix it because that turbine control system has been out of manufacturing for, I don't know, let's say 10 years, and the cost of a new one starts at $500,000. And that's for the most basic safety system. So you can see that it becomes a very different scale of just starting new with a new framework and patching and doing all that stuff. It's you have to think about how you do stuff. And that's what really is starting to scare me about IoT. Now, you could say containers and load balancing might help potentially, but that's assuming that the developers have not decided to use a new framework every 6 months, because you have testing to go on all this as well. So that it's so different, and that's the only way I can explain it. And if you think regular cybersecurity and development is kind of a niche section of society, we're talking about something that's like fringe of fringe.
Yeah. Okay. I have to thank our sponsor because somehow 33 minutes have gone by and I don't know how that happened. Thank you, folks from 10 Security, for sponsoring our podcast for several weeks in a row and buying a whole bunch of diversity scholarships. Yes, that's right. WeHack Purple has a diversity scholarship. It is to help people who are underrepresented in tech become more represented. So if you apply for the scholarship, which is open all the time, if you're selected, and a very large percentage are getting selected, like I think maybe over 50% are managing to get in, you get to take the entire Application Security Foundations program, and you get a copy of my book, and you get a certification at the end when you've completed all of the coursework. That said, what I was actually supposed to be talking about was how 10 Security is awesome. They are consultants that basically created Defect Dojo, which is a vulnerability management system. They're super nice dudes, and they will come and set up your DevOps pipelines and automate all the things. And it's pretty awesome. I've got to work with them before, and they are a blast. Also, WeHack Purple just released their newest course. It is called Secure Coding. It is a language agnostic course. It is $249 for an on-demand course of 3.5 hours worth of videos, 80 articles, checklists, quizzes, code review. So I'm supposed to tell you about that. And also this Saturday, we are doing Chapter 5 of Alice and Bob Learn Application Security. That's right, this Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Myself and a whole bunch of my friends are going to get together and be nerds and talk about the 5th chapter of the book, which I believe is Common Pitfalls. That means mistakes that we make a lot and that we need to fix. So I've done lots of marketing, and I would like to go back to Ron now and ask him more questions about like how someone could get. So Ron, I find this area of security really, really interesting. I remember in Ottawa, I got to see a talk, and how do I add you back in? I want to add you. There you are. Okay, awesome. I just forgot which button it was. I saw someone give a talk on this, and it was really, really interesting. But honestly, the person was full of beans, let's say. And I like that person. I was just like, well, that guy's just full of crap. But I was super fascinated by the topic. Like, how can someone get into this line of work? Because it's really niche. Like, I have people tell me what I do is niche, but that's, I got nothing on you. So like, how's someone even start?
Well, I had a bit of a head start. My mom and dad sold the most fuel for Chevron in North America and retired at a nice ripe age of mid-30s. So I got lucky. I got lucky that I was dipping tanks and going out in the fuel trucks with my dad back in the days. And by the way, I was born in Tofino. I lived in Ukulele. So, and now I live in Montreal, worlds apart. But I grew up in that environment. I grew up with people cutting down trees, getting oil out of the ground, going fishing, you know, all of that stuff. And for right or wrong, that made me behave certain ways and talk certain ways that are maybe a little less PC that I had to correct as I got older. But I grew up with a mindset of MacGyvering, making do with what you had, solving your own problems. For those of you that remember what man pages are, we had very slow internet. I grew up on it with 286s and trying to make stuff work. I was writing basic websites and getting Shaw Cable to host them, even with my, I don't know what I had, how much bandwidth I had, maybe 50 megabits per month, or I think megabytes of traffic per month. I think that's what I had when I was in like grade 4 or 5. I was making a silly website for something. That's what I preferred to do when I was super young. But I grew up solving problems. And I actually like to even ask people as an interview question, do you know how to change the oil or brakes on your car? Now, less people have cars than they used to now. But the reason why I say that is if you don't know how to do it, how would you go about finding the solution to that? And if you can't even come up with a question like, well, I'd go look up the model of my car. I'd go find a manual on the internet. I'd go get a jack and start or look at YouTube videos. Yeah. Then I've already disqualified you probably from the interview. Because my time is very valuable. I'm not saying that I don't wish to mentor people, but I want people that do the time to get ahead. I want them to want something, right? Versus me spoon feeding you and you not knowing why I'm speed fooding you. Like, I don't mind spoon feeding someone, but they have to understand the consequences, the impact of what I'm trying to teach. If you can't do that on your own, no matter amount of courses, university you go to, you're going to still struggle with life. It's like not having a mission. It takes you a lot longer to get focused, right? You might still achieve several objectives and goals and milestones in your life. So, because of the way I was brought up, and I got lucky of being in the right place several times, so arguably, again, luck is half of us being prepared, I actually did a diploma program as part of my high schooling at VIU, which at the time was called Malaspina, which is, I did a 2-year program called ITAS, Informational Technology and Applied Systems. And it was a mixture of systems dev to networking to basic programming. And I'm going to tell you, security was not one of the functions in any of those classes for programming, but we had a security plus thing. So before I even finished that security plus course, I'd already taken the exam. I'd already taken my network plus. I'd already taken my Linux plus before I even finished the diploma, because I was like, well, if I'm doing the course, I might as well validate that with something else for an extra couple $100 at the time. CompTIA is dirt cheap. Great place to get started in security and the basics, by the way, in terms of value per cert. Still like a decade later. Actually, it's more than a decade now. So I started there. And then I started working for a company that was based out of Lanceville called Tofino Security. We were the first in the world to industrial control systems and firewalls. And a gentleman named Eric Byers, who's still a good friend of mine, by the way, who just won the BC Ventures fundraiser, well, the thing for Adolis, which, by the way, is also SPAC in Lanceville and Nanaimo. So if you're in that realm and you're looking for some work, I know they're looking for some skilled persons, but not necessarily skilled in a particular language, but have the drive, the mission. Why are you doing this? Well, we're doing it to make critical infrastructure better, right? There's a reason why we're doing it. So he took me under his wing, and then I was doing technical destructive testing and all that stuff. And I said, I don't like doing this. So So I went and did my bachelor's in BCIT. And so the whole, you can see the whole trend of this was I knew what I wanted to do. And I did the time to do it, even if it was difficult. I bridged and skipped 2 years of school and went straight into my third year at BCIT because I did the time and did all the bridging while I was working. That is how I did it. So if you're going to try to get into a very high stress type environment, for right or wrong, not everyone could excel in it. There's room for everybody. But the way I did it was by doing the extra time, by learning. If I didn't know what that was, well, I Googled it until the cows came home. And then even if I still didn't understand it specifically, well, on Monday, you know, after the weekend on Monday, I'd go and ask that person, okay, I Googled it. Here's what I understand. Confirm, deny. Give me my next thing to Google so I can go figure it out on my own. That's how you get into this. You don't necessarily need to go and become an electrical engineer or a process control engineer, then go into cybersecurity. You don't need to be a web app developer necessarily to do embedded systems. You can do it if you got the drive. And that's my advice to everyone. If you want to get into the space, do the time, understand the language, understand what the customer's needs are, and you'll get there. It's really simple.
What type of technical skills do you think someone needs to be able to do? Because if we make a list of like the types of things they need to know, then they can go and clobber those things.
Good question. So here's a fun one. If you want to be a good web developer and do WebSockets, do you think it's important to know networking? Most web developers don't understand how TCP sockets work in TLS. That's a problem because you don't know how the secure connection set up nor the primitives. So you do need to have some fundamental skills and basics in there. No one's asking you to be an algorithmic and cryptographic wizard. They're just understanding that you need to know the primary basics. What is an IP address? What is a port? Oh, TLS implies this, this, and this. Those are the types of basic skills. So if I were to say, what were the basic skills to get in this besides your personal soft skills? Good fundamental programming skills. I know people say you don't need to learn that stuff in university. You can skip university degrees, but they do teach you vocabularies and primary basics that allow you to go Google and solve problems on your own, or teaches you what patterns are and some of the basic things. So when you do read documents from ACM and other digital publications for research, you understand what's being said and you say, oh, well, I know what that is. I don't need to do it exactly, but I can follow it. And I just need to use that, the algorithm or whatever that's in the library. So there's like some basic cryptography that you need to know, basic networking, basic fundamentals in architecting systems of systems, because not most of the time now you write a container, but it's actually got another container next to it and you're doing inter-container communication. Or how does a browser interpret what's going on, right? And you have all your stuff on a server that's being load balanced, and that load balancing is actually talking to a series of databases on the back end. And guess what? Your data, all of a sudden, your tables are locking. Well, you didn't do any profiling. So there's a bunch of core pragmatic skills that you need. And then I think in overall, just need to be inquisitive and try to just think through what you do. I had a junior ask me with one on my side that I mentor. He said, you know, you look like you just write the code last minute and you get it done. And I said, no, you don't understand. If I had 10 hours, 8 hours of that went into planning it, I'd write the code. And by the time I wrote the code, guess what? That code, because I didn't rush it and write terrible code all the way through, the next sprint I would have been fine because I'd set myself up for the next sprint because I thought it through. Part of that is experience based. But part of that is something else. So there's a whole bunch of things, not just skills that you need to acquire, but the way you think and the way that you plan, and also just try to glue different, even disparate experiences together, and you'll find out that different domains all talk the same. So if you take electrical engineering, take computer science, you merge them together, you're going to find that you're going to go really far together. So skills are like cybersecurity by itself or secure development, they're kind of verticals, but they're not disparate and they're not independent from each other. You can always quilt them together and get places. So if someone said, what skills do I need? It's very, very tricky to say which specific ones. It depends on what you want to do. Yeah.
Yeah. We have some comments about, yes, set the foundation first and then build. And yeah, I think that's really great. So I have so many questions. How did we go 45 minutes already? Like, you just got here. also, I mean, like, before we finish, I hope we can see the dog again. But what do you like best and what do you like least about what you do? And also, actually, first, before that question, so Adolus is hiring. So that's A-D-O-L-U-S. So would that be like adolus.com probably?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So for anyone that is wondering about that, you can find that.
Absolutely. And you'll probably stumble across a very important thing, which we need to consider nowadays, especially under Biden's XO in the United States, is software bills and materials. So that's what they're going about. And I recommend everyone wonder about where your code came from and what you've done to it. And because there's a few things to be said there. Just because something they're using has a pack that says it's Linux and a particular version does not mean it is exactly as it is. You've modified it. You've adulterated it. There's so much more to think about than just, oh, I've used this package and it came from Debian or it came from Red Hat. It's been adulterated and modified by the maintainers. And so one vulnerability might not apply to you because you've done something else. So there's so much there that we all take for granted when we ask Visual Studio or whatever IDE is, go import, sure. But you forgot the rest of it is you don't know what you imported and what the consequences are. Now, if you're doing web apps, maybe that's not so bad. Although with supply chain attacks, that's true. But yeah, there's a whole world there. So that's what Adolus is doing. I'm giving them a free pitch because they're in Canada as well. And for programmers,
Canada.
For programmers, definitely it could be a very interesting way to get started in your career.
For sure. So I have been informed I must ask the cheese question, but first, what do you like best and what do you like the least about what you do? Because what you do is very specialized. It's different than a lot of other jobs. And I bet there's different things that are kind of awesome and different things that are not awesome.
The part that's not awesome is that every time I do an assessment, I always find things wrong that we've been telling people to do right for the last 20 years. That is beyond frustrating. The other thing is I'm seeing new products also winding up with all the same mistakes that were quite some years ago. And they're actually being made, they're actually being amplified by the amount of extra things being allowed in a device. So before you had a 300 megahertz CPU, you had 16 megs of flash, if you were lucky, and maybe 32 megs of RAM. There's only so much you could do and so much you could put on that thing. But now you've got a quad core with a gig of RAM with whatever you wanted for a piece of NAND flash. You could have a 10, 30 gigs, whatever, 4 gigs, whatever. And so you're winding up with a system that's got everything in the kitchen sink in it. And actually attackers don't need to even bring any tools with you because you gave them the whole platform for free. So certain parts of my life are getting harder, and we're going to see what that's going to look like. And by the way, all those IoT devices that you're buying get abandoned so fast, not just because the vendors are disappearing or they're abandoning the product. The hardware has changed, and so they don't maintain the product. The whole world there too. That's the parts I don't like. And the slow pace of which you see security moving. It's hard to find budgets. Imagine trying to get a whole bunch of fiber laid and get all this equipment if you're stuck because of Cisco right now. If you're trying to find the budget for where it's like $5 or $6 per foot, but then you haven't counted in the cost of the swap over, the shutdowns, all that. That sucks. What do I like best? I'm seeing more and more of the devices that I've actually built for security. Before I left one of my employers in 2014, I see them much more regularly now. So that's what I love about my job. Stuff I've made is showing up in the workplace. I'm having calls from product security officers as a friend to ask about particular questions and how do I deal with this. Being recognized and having my articles going around in certain circles where I didn't know that I was classified, and it turns out they classified what I wrote. That's the nice part about what I do. And that's what I enjoy. Or having individuals come up to me and I help them present and I watch them do great. That's what I love about my job. Even though it's not part of my job, it's what I do just as my own profession. So that's what makes me keep doing what I'm doing.
Oh, I love it. That's such a fantastic answer. So now the cheese question. So I was trying to figure out like a polite way to say, does your job pay well for what you do? And so we came up with the cheese question because it's like, are you able to buy as much cheese as you want? Because cheese is an expensive grocery store item. But you and I were talking a little bit about this before the show, where we're talking about how security engineers, it's just off the charts how much they're charging now because there's just not enough of us and companies are having a lot of trouble affording the security teams they need. What's sure. the answer?
Well, I'll break that into a few parts. I am paid very, very well. But not well enough in the sense where the housing prices have gone up to such a point that even if I could do the down payment, I don't want to drop that much money per month on just a mortgage payment. That makes no sense. So that's my answer to you. But I do say that it is enough cheese. So enough cheese is something very interesting to think about for a lot of people. Is I've managed to buy happiness. So I bought ET, which is now the price with all the shots as the price of a small used car, and then. You have my boat, which was I named it Happiness because it's proof you can buy it. I love water. It's what I want to retire early in the next 5 years to live on water. That's all I want. So there's enough cheese, although right now the housing market's kind of ruining how much cheese is necessary to get there, but that's one piece. In terms of salaries, that's a very good point. So generally things pay quite well, but people need to be very mindful of who can pay what. So just because Google can pay $180,000 does not mean that the government of Canada can do so. Because to do so means that all of our taxes need to go up, or price of everything goes up, or we'll make do with less, right? So I'll hire one individual, but not five. Those are very interesting things to think about. You need to be very conscious about. So again, what's enough cheese for your lifestyle is a very important question to ask yourself. Mm-hmm. You ask for lots of money, guess what? Double the work is expected from you. And learning is on your own dime and dollar or on your own weekends. And guess what? That's life. There's also, to be honest, I don't think there's actually a shortage of resources. I think if you looked on LinkedIn, there's tons of candidates. What there is a shortage, though, of is individuals who can think for themselves, can add 1 plus 1 or maybe 2 plus 2. That's the part that's missing. And if you consider, let's pick, I don't know, a smaller business in Nanaimo or Victoria, that's probably under $1 million of revenue. They don't, and they're
mine.
There you go. So could you afford to pay someone software engineering 120 or 160? And the benefits on top of that, 4 weeks of vacation and so on. We need to start being realistic. And most people that are asking for salaries have never ran or owned a business in their life.
Yeah.
Or been exposed to one. And that's the really hard truth that I don't like telling people is you think you might be worth that, but guess what? The market's going to collapse and though you better be worth 160 when the market collapses or those businesses are having a bad day. You better have skills across the board to make yourself worth it. There's a lot to be said about how much cheese and how much you can ask and what's realistic in the market. I mean, the job market is going to crash and the bubble is going to break and a lot of people aren't going to have jobs, unfortunately, I suppose, but that's just my belief.
I'm honestly hopeful that we can create a lot more security engineers, like by making training more affordable, like not just We Hack Purple, I mean the industry in general. I'm hoping that like schools, universities, colleges, even high schools start actually teaching stuff that can land people jobs so they don't have to pay $7,000 American per course that they want to take.
Talking about SANS?
No, but it's just, it makes it unaffordable. And you mentioned the Canadian government. So I think one of the problems with the Canadian government is that they pay help desk the exact same amount that they pay software developers and the exact same amount that they pay cybersecurity people.
Yeah.
So like I held the highest technical position available for like a decade. And I remember like talking to the help desk dude and it's like, the help desk skill set is easier to come by than the cybersecurity skill set because of cost of training, because of certain amounts of experience you need to get there. And it doesn't mean that their work do not have value. That's not what I'm trying to say. But in the market, it has a different value. But the Canadian government lumps them all into the same thing. And it's like, I'm sorry, I'm not willing to take a $50,000 pay cut to work for the government. It's ridiculous.
And part of the shortage isn't necessarily like if you look at LinkedIn or Twitter, you'll find a whole deluge, a rainstorm, if you will, of of pen testers, malware analysts and stuff. But if you really consider how many jobs are actually available that look for those specific things, it's teensy compared to what the market actually needs. The market needs administrators that are capable for Windows boxes. We need people to do all of these things properly, which, by the way, are generally the reason why all the systems are getting hacked or popped. Same with coding, right? So you brought up a good point. Most of the coding examples that you see on Stack Overflow, the coding examples you saw in your textbooks, garbage. That's also true for embedded IoT devices, where the SDK that comes from VxWorks or ARM is full of and riddled through holes. I make jokes about even Qt Linux or Qt in C is that they're not even doing the practices that they're recommending. So there's multiple areas that we need to be doing this, and you don't necessarily need to have to be a cybersecurity only person. Most of the cybersecurity professionals that I know that are, let's say, like ourselves, we didn't necessarily come from that. We came from a different background, and we learned security as an additive to our roles, more so, or at least that's how I did it. It became an additive. I came as a developer and I learned security along the way. Most of the time you don't learn if you learn security first and you don't learn how to program, that could be helpful, but that's not usually how it works. That's not what the employer wants. So it's a very delicate dance, depending on which job role it is and what industry you're in and so on. I don't think there's a formula, but there's a lot of finesse.
I would rather have one skilled AppSec person with a whole bunch of software developers that have secure coding knowledge and experience than having like 10 people on the AppSec team, but none of the devs have like any security training. They have no security knowledge. It's much better to enable everyone to do their job securely than to hire 100 security staff to run around and whack people with sticks.
Absolutely. I mean, that's true, I think, in every software development thing, right? Like I'll take a video game company in Canada, and you have a very famous game, and there was roughly, I'm just going to round the numbers, but it was 100 developers. 10 of those were doing probably 80% of the work. 10. 20 of them were probably doing the other, like another 10% of that work, or maybe even 30. And the rest were just doing things, looking for spelling mistakes and having coffee in the coffee shop that was built into the building. And just, trudging behind the wagon, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but that kind of tells you a lot is the majority of what we need to be doing in terms of security is really related to discipline. Having the ethic to be like, that looks stinky, let's fix it. Versus just putting it off. There's so much that we can fix and we can do and to make it a part of our job. But just, I don't know the right answers to all this. I wish I did. I mean, but I have a feeling that even in 15, 20 years, nothing is going to have really have changed. Just that the technology will have changed names more than anything or gone more virtualized.
I don't like that I have to agree with you because a lot of what you're saying is true, but I wish it wasn't true. So it's hard. I could talk to you all night, but I'm definitely getting the you are supposed to wrap up now signals. If people want to learn more about you, if they want to follow you, what are their options, Ron?
Sure. So you could go through verbindustrial.com and you can read a bunch of my ramblings on the blog or white papers. Some of them will have a little marketing twist. But if you wish to get a hold of me, you can reach out to me through my Twitter, Ron_Brash, B-R-A-S-H, or you can even add me on LinkedIn, and I would be more than happy to add you back and have a conversation with you however you wish, even if it was a one-on-one call to ask and answer certain questions. So feel free to reach out to me however you wish, even if it was about the wakeboards behind me or about ET, the Canadian EPT, and I would be more than happy. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I want to just spell out Verve Industrial for anyone that's listening that can't see. So it's Verve, like remember the band, the Verve. So V-E-R-V-E, and then industrial, just the way you would think, and then .com. Because sometimes with podcasts, we speak quickly, and I want to make sure everyone can go and visit. Oh my gosh, ET, the Canadian APT. Thank you so much, Ron. Thank you. Thank you to ET for joining us and being adorbs. Oh my gosh, heart melting. Seriously, everyone on the internet is missing the cutest dog on the planet. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing all this amazing knowledge. This is really, really great. I felt like you had a lot of fantastic advice, especially about like just setting a really good foundation, having the good work ethic. And I love how you're like, plus you have to have a certain amount of soft skills. Like this is automatic. You have to have some skills. That comes up a lot on this show.
And we could talk about how soft skills are important, whether you're male, female, neurodivergent. If you want to get promotions and not to get passed across, soft skills are very important as in advertising your own brand. We could have a whole another webinar on that as well.
Ron, I feel like you and I could talk for 4 hours, honestly. Are you going to B-Sides Calgary? Just like totally random. We have purple sponsors. B-Sides Calgary, but okay, no, you're not. Okay, just wondering. Thank you again, and I'm going to actually say goodbye. I'm really bad at saying goodbye. So this is Ron Brash. He does ICS Security. I'm Tanya Janka. I want to thank all of you so much for coming to this show. Thank you, Kellen. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, everyone who showed up. Thank you especially to Ron. Oh my gosh, that was such a great conversation. Thank you to our amazing sponsor, 10 Security. We appreciate you guys. I am Tanya Janka, your host, and up this Saturday, July 10th, is Chapter 5, Common Pitfalls of Alice and Bob Learn Application Security. We are going to talk about the OWASP Top 10 and how it is not a standard. We're going to talk about a bunch of other common pitfalls like race conditions, buffer overflows, and all sorts of other stuff that you as software developers need to be concerned about, and most of all, how to fix them. Thank you again. Oh, and you can join in at 1 p.m. by going to YouTube/SheHacksPurple. That's me, your resident nerd. And so thank you so much, and we will see you next week.